was fixed on his father. His expression hardly changed at all. It carried all the serenity of monastic life in its gaze. Mike then took over the main storyline of the narrative. All of us, he said, had been witnesses to the change in Shyla Fox once she met Radical Bob Merrill, who had transferred to Carolina from Columbia University during the summer of 1969. Bob had been with the Radicals who had taken over Columbia's administration building and issued a series of demands so stringent that the New York police were called in to break the siege during a brutal pre-dawn raid that did great harm to Columbia's illustrious progressive reputation. Radical Bob himself had been asleep in Harlem when the raid took place because he was learning to make incendiary bombs from a black Muslim on probation for use in disabling police units sent to interfere with political demonstrations. He came south to start a branch of the Students for a Democratic Society at the University of South Carolina. His first recruit on campus was Shyla Fox. Before he left the university, he had built the SDS chapter to a membership of just over 50. He shaped them to his own will and educated them politically. So gifted was Radical Bob at organizing the somnolent students of the university that he received a special citation from national headquarters. But this was later, after Kent State and the storm that had broken the lives of all of us gathered at the Dock Street Theater. "I had never seen anybody like Radical Bob," Mike said. "He had long black hair like an Indian, spoke three languages, could quote entire pages of Walt Whitman, Karl Marx. Nothing fazed him or bothered him. He wasn't a good public speaker, but what a judge of character, of leadership. He knew the South distrusted outsiders, so he set about the business of seducing Southerners to do his bidding. He stayed in the background, invisible, pulling the strings. He began our political education, no doubt about that. Except for Shyla, I don't think any of us had given two thoughts about the war. We were ripe for the picking. I'd been waiting my whole life for someone like Radical Bob. Cool. He wrote the script for cool. He made ideas come alive. All of us bought into his game plan. Except Jordan." Radical Bob, dressed impeccably in a Brooks Brothers suit, his hair styled and his nails manicured, said, "Jordan was completely immune to the charms of revolutionary thought. He was far too emotional to be trusted in a political movement. His only danger to me was the allegiance he inspired in his friends. In their innocence, Shyla and Mike revered him. But I saw an alien. I discouraged Shyla and Mike from their friendship with Jordan. I did the same with Jack." "But I was your real victory, Bob," Capers said. "I was your pièce de résistance." "Ah, yes," Bob said, smiling at Capers. "I set my sights on you in my first month on campus. Shyla and, to a lesser extent, Mike were great catches, but let's face it, they were Jewish and still could be discounted by the southern dimwits I was trying to reach. I used my own Jewishness to hook them, but with you, I had to come up with a longer-range plan. So I drew up a strategy. When I found out about the Waterford connection among you, I suggested that Shyla start bringing all of you together at yesterday's, a friendly gathering over a beer where we could eventually lead the conversation toward serious things, toward the war, toward a response to the war, and, of course, in the back of my mind, toward civil disobedience." "The phrase of yours I remember best," Capers said, "was this one. If there's to be blood in the rice paddies of Vietnam, there must also be an equivalent amount of blood shed in the streets of South Carolina." "I learned a lot from you, Bob. You and Shyla were my best students. You could move a crowd like no one I ever saw, Capers." "Vietnam made us all passionate, one way or the other," Capers said. "The art of kissing did funny things to Judas, too," I said, not bothering to look up at Capers. "Hit the hammer, Dad, before these two lovebirds slide off the stage in their own slime." Both Bob and Capers laughed, but the laughter was born of nervousness, and the tension in the theater tightened like a spring. Father Jude coughed. Celestine excused herself and made her way to the ladies' room. Ladere leaned forward in her seat. The gavel came down again, and Mike continued the story that was bringing all of us into the sulphurous, exhausted past. It was Mike who spoke, but I felt myself remembering everything as I conjured up those gatherings in yesterday's. From the start, the Waterford crowd was central to the life of the university because, as a group, we were uncommonly active in student life. Ladere was swept up in cheerleading, sororities, and beauty pageants, carrying on the Southern traditions. She ran in place while the rest of us exhausted ourselves, screaming epithets at each other, arguing late at night, trying to change everything by the force of our ideas. We liked being smart, and we liked being loud, and Radical Bob picked up the tab for all the beer we drank at yesterday's. Ladere broke up with Capers shortly after he met Radical Bob. A month later, Capers dropped out of his fraternity, Kappa Alpha, after delivering an anti-war speech to his K.A. brothers. By the end of 1969, Capers Middleton, scion of one of the oldest and most distinguished families in South Carolina history, descendant of three signers of the Declaration of Independence, had become the acknowledged leader of the SDS and the radical student movement at South Carolina. In the background stood Bob Merrill, offering instruction, advice, and political direction. Second in command was Shyla, who now shared both Capers's bed and his commitment to stop the war in Southeast Asia and bring every American soldier home. To my own regret, Capers and Shyla were inseparable figures on campus during those heady, unbridled days. In the mornings, they drank espresso at the UFO coffee house on Gervais Street, trying to talk young soldiers at Fort Jackson into declaring their opposition to the war. They traveled together all over the country, attending demonstrations and conferences involving leaders in the peace movement. Shyla became famous for her beauty and eloquence, Capers for his courage in facing police lines, and his ability to combine passion and practicality in the speeches he delivered every day to groups that ranged in number from 5 to 1,000. His oratory had a purring, hallucinatory quality that could spellbind a crowd within minutes. Shyla was the true revolutionary, Radical Bob said. I knew as soon as I discovered her that she was a once-in-a-lifetime deal. I saw her cry when one of the other girls described the night her pet cat died 10 years before. Shyla didn't know either the cat or the girl, but she had empathy for all God's creatures. It made her exciting, and it made her naive. But you could take Shyla to the bank. She was the real thing. I think she was in love with Jack even then, but Jack wasn't political, and he wouldn't change. Capers won her love by tossing off his past life and manning the barricades with her. Shyla felt that Capers was her own creation. Of course, I felt the exact same way about her. Shyla believed the Vietnam War was evil, but her vision was complicated by her parents' story. Her Jewishness was the key to all her anti-war activity. To her, the Vietnamese were Jews. The Americans were the invading army, so they became the Nazis in her mind. Every time I argued with Shyla about the war, she took me on a field trip to Auschwitz. Talk about the siege of Khe Sanh with the Marines, and suddenly she had me riding in a cattle car across the Polish countryside. I learned that I was a different kind of Jew than Shyla. My mother and father had this extraordinary gratitude about America. I looked at the world through my parents' eyes. She looked at the world, and her vision was obscured by her father's tattoo. I think she had a need to protest the war because no one said a word when her parents and their families were taken by the Nazis. Every picture of a dead Vietnamese reminded her of ditches piled with Jews. Her protest, her radicalism, everything was an extension of her family life. But Shyla's feelings were the realest thing about her. It was life and death with her.
"What was it for my son?" General Elliot asked. "I accept your description of Shyla's protest. Her sincerity I never doubted. Shyla was pure of spirit. By changing a few words of your description, you could have been describing a perfect infantryman. But tell me about Jordan. As far as I knew, he was as apolitical as Jack. Yet both of them got caught up in this foolishness. I never understood it."
"Shyla wouldn't rest until she enlisted Jordan and Jack in SDS," Capers explained. "They'd laugh and tease her about her newfound radicalism. For a while, they called her Jane Fonda. But she got them to the rallies and the speeches. They were smart guys, and if they hadn't been playing baseball, I think they'd have gotten involved earlier." "We were carried away by events," I said. "Things occurred beyond our control." "You take it from here, Jack," Mike said, and I nodded and took the witness chair. Chapter 36.
I began my part of the telling slowly, but I tried to get my facts right. It would be a while before I was brought into the main action, but I was certainly a witness to the startling changes among my friends. Once Schuyler and Capers discovered the anti-war movement, they were lost to us. Though they went to class only sporadically, they still maintained good grades. At 21, Capers Middleton and Schuyler Fox were the two most famous college students in the state who were not athletes. They were regulars on the evening news and were widely quoted and photographed in the papers. Their first arrest took place when they protested a visit of DuPont to the campus to recruit graduates for the corporation which manufactured napalm. Their second arrest took place a week later when they tried to block an exit to the amphitheater when President Nixon was speaking in Charlotte. During this time, it seemed as if Capers and Schuyler had passed into some twilight world of fanaticism. There were no questions about the war they could not answer. The two of them brimmed with the righteousness of their cause. And each week, the anti-war movement grew stronger on campus because of their zeal and their remarkable skills of confrontation, organization, and debate. But for most of us, college was still the center of our lives. Often after his classes, Jordan would walk over to the yearbook offices to meet me and sometimes Mike. I wrote almost all the copy for 3 straight yearbooks, and Mike took more photographs than anyone who had ever worked for the Garnet and Black. In one photograph, Mike had caught the essence of the annual Miss Venus contest, where co-eds from the sororities dressed in tight blouses, short shorts, and high heels, and paraded across a stage wearing paper bags over their heads. It was a traditional way to judge the Carolina woman who possessed the most desirable body. The jury was a leering batch of fraternity boys, famous for their testosterone level. Mike's photograph captured the bagged, anonymous heads of this girl's lineup, their strained, pigeon-like bosoms stuck out and shoved toward the camera lens, for the pleasure of one grotesque, ogling face of a fraternity boy, appreciating breasts that seemed to stretch out into infinity. I captioned it the Teat Offensive. When President Tom Jones invited us to explain the play on words, Mike and I both insisted it was a printer's error. Slowly, Mike succumbed to the call of Radical Bob, but he still loved the yearbook. From the start, we saw it as our opportunity to record history with our own signatures and slants on every page. For us, the Garnet and Black was part epistle, part Rosetta Stone, Hallmark card, Socratic dialogue, and census report. It was a bright accumulation of life assembled from the formlessness of 10,000 lives thrown together in a great bouillabaisse and simmered for 4 years. But when Capers and Schuyler chalked up their 6th arrest of the year in December of 1969, I said goodbye to all that. Mike and Jordan and I went down to bail them out. By this time, we were pros at bailing out our friends, since Capers's and Schuyler's parents had washed their hands of any responsibility for their offspring's legal entanglements. The Foxes shared the immigrant's dread of offending the authorities, while Capers's parents cut him off because he was destroying the reputation of a family name long celebrated in South Carolina history texts. Without parental support, the two of them often found themselves casualties of rough police work and were handcuffed and dragged by the hair into waiting paddy wagons. They learned that the police were blue-collar workers who had come out of marginal suburbs. They could easily hate the sight of long-haired, spoiled college kids who did not mind using the American flag to start up fires along the boulevards. A nightstick had put Capers in the hospital in November. Schuyler received a punch with a closed fist by a highway patrolman later that month. On this particular evening, a deputy named Willis Sheely took exception to the way I looked. Night had fallen, and I knew this was a dangerous time in southern jails, but my politeness was ingrained, even natural. The slack-jawed, hostile deputy sized me up in a way that told me I was in trouble.
"I got a sister with big tits whose hair isn't half as long as yours," Sheely said.
"The bondsman said the papers are all in order, sir," I said, avoiding eye contact.
"You hear what I said?" the deputy demanded.
"Yes, sir, I did."
"Your friend in there's got hair down to his ass. He got a dick or a pussy between his legs."
"Sir," I said, "you'll have to ask Capers that."
"Get smart with me, boy. You'll be spending the night with your buddy," Sheila said.
And just then, Jordan walked into the Columbia jail to see what was holding me up. Jordan had long ago returned to his California style and had one of the first ponytails among Carolina men. "What's the problem?" Jordan asked.
"Another one," Sheila said, shaking his head in disgust. "If that college don't have a chicken coop full of faggots."
But Jordan had no sense of restraint. "Look, loser, just let our friend out of jail and you can get back to counting your acne scars."
"My friend likes to joke around," I suggested.
Willis Sheely lifted his billy club from the metal desk in front of him and said,
"He's joking with death. I played football in high school."
"Oh, God, did you hear that, Jack?" Jordan said, lifting his hands in mock terror. "I wouldn't have dared open my mouth if I'd have known our superhero had played football. He must be one of those ass-kicking, take-no-prisoners sort of guys. My knees always get weak when I'm face-to-face with a fat-assed, pimple-faced dickhead who brags he played high school football." Watching the billy club, I said,
"Shut up, Jordan. Could you please release our friend, sir?"
"I don't like your faggot friend,"
the deputy said, taking a step closer to Jordan, who responded by moving a step toward Sheely.
"My friend hasn't been feeling well," I said.
The deputy laughed and said,
"Can't cure diarrhea of the mouth."
"I puke every time I smell the body odor of the village redneck," Jordan said. "Thanks for helping defuse the situation," I said. "Hey, anytime I can lend a hand."
"I bet you love to suck dick, don't you, faggot?" Sheila said.
"Sir, if you could just hold your tongue, I think I can reason with my friend," I said. "Neither of you are helping me out." "I happen to be an aficionado of sucking dick," Jordan said, enjoying himself now. The muscles in Sheely's clenched jaw tightened.
"Aficionado?"
"Of course. That word's three syllables too long for you to handle, Sheely. But I've sucked some of the finest dicks in this country. I'm a master of the trade. My tongue is celebrated in queer bars around the country. I love fat dicks and skinny dicks. Some dicks taste like cheese, others like fresh pork, some like beef jerky, some like corn on the cob, but my favorite tastes like sugar cane. Some guys' hygiene leaves something to be desired, you know. Guys like you, Sheely. Guys who bathe once a month, whether they need it or not. Then a sardine taste comes to mind, or maybe anchovies."
Jordan was on a roll, and I had rarely seen him enjoying himself more. "You're one sick son of a bitch," Sheely said. "I wouldn't let a pervert like you in my jail."
"Just release our friend, Mr. Middleton," I said, "and I'll get this pervert out of your sight."
"I bet you're hung like a horse, Mr. Sheely," Jordan said, joking, moving another step forward as Sheely retreated. "I bet I couldn't even fit the whole thing in my mouth."
"If your friend moves a step closer," Sheely said to me, "I'll shoot both of you. Watch him now while I get your friend inside."
As Sheely went back into the cell block, I said, "I got some problems with your technique."
"You were kissing ass," Jordan said cheerfully. "It didn't appear to be working."
"One should not scare a county deputy," I advised. "They're paid too little money, and the only fun they have is killing someone brought in for a speeding violation."
"I thought you knew the South," Jordan said. "The only reason both of us aren't dead right now is because we're white."
"You need to be more cautious," I advised.
"Caution dulls me," said Jordan matter-of-factly. "I only begin to get interested when I throw caution to the wind."
"Do me a favor," I said. "Let me know when you do so I can get out of your way."
Jordan said, "Don't be colorless, Jack. Promise me you won't be colorless."
"It's what I aspire to," I said, as Capers was let out of the cell block by a still-shaken Sheely.
"What on earth did you say to poor Deputy Sheely?" Capers said on seeing us. "He's trembling like a leaf." "Take your next demonstration outside the Richland County line, Middleton," Sheely warned, "and buy your squirrely friend there some mouthwash."
"Good line, Officer Sheely," Jordan said. "I love it when the hoi polloi come up with a clever comeback. It gives me renewed faith in the possibilities of public education for the masses."
"What the hell's he talking about?" Sheely asked me.
"Remember, Sheely," Jordan said, "the South's about story, not repartee."
"What an asshole," Sheely answered.
"You're a genius, sir."
Jordan said. You returned fire with both story and repartee. Capers pulled his long hair back with both hands and asked, What's Jordan been drinking?
He's high on life, I said. Let's make like horseshit and hit the trail.
That's a Boy Scout joke, said Capers. If only my scoutmaster could see me now.
Trying to destroy America, Jordan said, and everything that made us great.
Trying to save America, Capers said, his face growing serious.
You've become something of a grump since you set out to save the planet and all its singing birds, Capers, Jordan said.
Let's continue this discussion at yesterday's, I suggested. Mike has bailed out Jane Fonda. She'll want to yell at us, too.
We all went off to yesterday's, where Mike and Shyla were already nursing a drink at a table. Capers and Shyla kissed passionately, as was their habit in those heady days of arrests and speeches shouted out of bullhorns. They held hands in public, were affectionate in ways that made me extremely uncomfortable and caused Jordan to avert his eyes. It was not enough that they were living together. Their unvoiced message seemed to be that the fury of their beliefs had deepened the intensity of their sexual life. As we sat waiting for our beers in yesterday's, their hands moved along each other's bodies as though the curves of their own pliant flesh were the only braille they could trust.
"Unglue yourselves," Mike said, "so we can order."
"You're just jealous," Capers said, staring deeply into Shyla's eyes.
"I feel like I've lost my arms and legs when we're apart. It's like we've been one ever since the revolution took off."
"What revolution?" I asked.
"When are you going to wake up, Jack?" Shyla said sharply. "How many bodies are going to have to pile up in Vietnam before it claims a share of your attention?"
72,368, I said, studying the menu.
How can you make jokes when young American boys are dying in an immoral war? Capers asked, grabbing my wrist.
Jordan was reading from his own menu and said, I want a cheeseburger smothered with onions, and there's that fabulous hot dog also waiting to be eaten. Something in me also craves a salad, but then I think of those boys dying in an immoral war, and I realize I don't want food at all. I want to carry a placard and march in an anti-war demonstration and be morally superior to every human being I pass.
I thought I was going to get a T-bone steak, I added, but I can't think about red meat without thinking of Hue and body bags loaded up with young men who will never hear the words of the Gettysburg Address again. The T-bone seems immoral to me.
Then I think about getting the red beans and rice, but the rice reminds me of the poor Viet Cong who are being killed while fighting a moral war against perfect shitheads like me. The rice is out. I want to order something that has no political message at all, so I think I'll get a raw carrot and a glass of water.
Mike warned, Capers and Shyla don't think you boys are very funny.
Too bad, I said.
Tough titty, Jordan added.
What's funny about Vietnam? Shyla asked.
It's made our whole country crazy, I said. It's turned wonderful people like the two of you into fanatics. Look at you, Capers, from K.A. to Abby Hoffman in a calendar year. And you, Shyla, you were more fun to be around than anyone I've ever met, but now I'd rather read back copies of the Congressional Record than be near your sorry ass. I don't understand why you can't be a liberal without turning into smug, pious assholes.
We're trying to stop the war, Jack, Capers said. I'm sorry our piety ruins your fun.
Do you stand for anything? Shyla asked.
The Star-Spangled Banner, I said.
Cheap patriotism, Capers sneered. What I love about the American flag is one doesn't have to stand up for it. One can burn it, stomp on it, or throw it in the trash, and our Constitution grants us that precious right.
There's a fascist in you, Jack, waiting to be born, Shyla said.
If it's ever born, it'll be because I hung around you and Capers too long, I said. Every time I'm with you, I want to drop an H-bomb on Hanoi.
So you're for the war, Shyla shouted. Admit it.
We're in college, Jordan said. No one's for this war. It's a stupid war fought for stupid reasons by stupid people.
Then you're on our side, Shyla said.
Yeah, we're on your side, Jordan said. We're just a lot quieter about it.
I can't be quiet about napalm and children on fire running down country roads, Capers said.
Neither can I, said Shyla. Nor can I sit with anyone who can. As she and Capers rose to leave, I stood and said, "I'd like to make a toast to napalm. May it only strike innocent children, orphans clutching teddy bears, paraplegics, amputees waiting for prosthetic devices, beloved cartoon characters, nuns with rosaries and bad breath, cheerleaders from the Atlantic Coast Conference." I was still compiling my list when Capers and Shala made their way out into the darkness. "Humor's not their long suit these days," Mike said, snapping photographs of all of us as they retreated. "It's all false," I said. "They've fallen in love with rhetoric and bullshit. They can talk for hours about free speech, and then get pissed off when anyone says something they disagree with." Mike said, "That's not why you're angry, Jack." "Mike's right," Jordan said. "Well, then why am I angry?" I asked. "It's good to have two friends who are all wise and all knowing, and who can explain the ways of the world to their slow-witted friend." "You're in love with Shyla," Mike said. "No sin in that. But she only gets excited by the boys who run away from tear gas." "I'm against the war," I said, "but I like America, so kill me." "She's in a very radical stage," Mike explained. "They're not serious about stopping this war," Jordan said, taking a long pull from his bottle. "I think they are," Mike disagreed. "No, they aren't. I don't agree with my old man very much," Jordan said. "But he said you could know how serious you were about something by how willing you were to risk everything for it. He told me last month that he wouldn't take Capers seriously until Capers gave him some sign that this wasn't just play-acting." "What would Capers have to do?" I asked. Jordan laughed. "He said if Capers believed what he says he does, he'd blow up every barracks at Fort Jackson. My father doesn't mistake anyone for the real thing unless they're willing to lay down their lives for their beliefs. When Capers and Shyla kill their first MP, he'll start listening to them." The war didn't come home to us until months later, the day Jordan was in my room reading Thomas Merton's Seven Story Mountain, and I was writing a letter to my mother. Mike appeared in the doorway. "Hear the news?" he asked, carrying three cameras around his neck. "National Guardsmen killed some college students at an anti-war demonstration. Listen." Jordan turned his head and said, "People are screaming." I looked out the window and saw students emptying trash out the windows of the education building. Others were running down the streets, screaming and crying. "Shala and Capers have called for a rally," Mike exclaimed. "All this because Nixon bombed Cambodia. Wow, never underestimate the power of cause and effect." From the second story window, Mike began snapping the bizarre, sometimes violent reaction of students to the news of what we would soon learn were the Kent State killings. It was one measure of President Nixon's innocence that he would have little idea how incendiary his incursion into Cambodia would prove to be among us, even the nation's most compliant students. A fearful discharge of energy was set off in the hearts of those of us who had long ago grown accustomed to our roles as wards of the state. We poured out of dormitories and fraternity and sorority houses and left our books untended in library carrels. We wandered singly and in pairs until we gathered in a group that was moving toward the Horseshoe, past the open plaza outside of the Russell House. Disoriented and without any sense of purpose, we registered incomprehension, grief, and betrayal over the senseless murder of four of our own. If the deaths had occurred at the already radicalized Harvard or Columbia, there would have been some context, some force of mitigating circumstances. But the gunning down of 13 students in the idyllic heartland town of Kent, Ohio, at Kent State, a college far more deferential in its acquiescence to authority than even the University of South Carolina, was inconceivable. It was clear to us that the government had declared open season on anyone opposing the war. On that single day, in the milling, insurgent coming together of the students of America, all the dangers of solidarity were set loose. Even the most docile and passive of students felt the hot breath of mutiny in the air as we walked toward the Horseshoe. Grievance would soon turn to rage, and meekness turn mean, then majestic. What was happening in this blind migration of students toward the open space between the library and the Russell House was taking place on campuses all over America. Intellect and reason had gone underground, civility hibernated, and insurrection took the lead. Yet none of us knew where we were going. Later, I thought that this moving without reason had been an unforgettable sensation that made me understand the comfort of herds, the safety that great numbers lend to religious pilgrimages. I had never been a part of something so much larger than myself. My hands trembled with fury, and my mouth was dry. I felt irrational and murderous, yet curiously not angry as I walked with the students, many crying around me. By the time we reached the open space in front of the library, Capers and Shala had already been arrested for unlawful assembly. News of their arrest spread angrily through the crowd, along with the surprising fact that the president of the university himself had secured their releases. Like an overhang of mist from the Saluda River, the mob dissipated, almost shyly, breaking up as though a spell had been lifted by an unseen hand. That night, Jordan, Mike, and I were at yesterday's when Shala and Capers walked in. They were welcomed by a thunderous ovation as they moved toward the bar with their fists raised and people reaching out to touch them. Capers wore a butterfly band-aid over his left eye where one of the arresting officers had banged his head against a wall. Shala went to the front entrance of the restaurant and worked the crowd into a lather of self-righteousness, while Capers and Radical Bob worked the back door and the bar. Shouts echoed through the streets, and a police car went up in flames near the stadium. The sound of sirens hovered over the city. It was not anarchy, or even near it, but something had disturbed the sediments of dispassion in the loose boundaries of this college. You could feel the thrill of lethargy set afire. On this night, the pure fact of living seemed like a new branch of theology. There was wildness and disquiet along the tree-lined streets of a sleeping city. Over the televisions and the radios came the news that none of the slain students had been a radical, and one had even belonged to a ROTC unit. The men in uniforms had turned their guns on college students. My generation cohered in outrage, and parents everywhere were afraid. The next afternoon, the gathering began again, and I learned that the instinctual was far more fearful than the scheduled or the planned. The mob again made its way toward the end of the horseshoe, and once more I felt the thrill of being part of something much larger than myself, as I was swept along by the movement of thousands. Jordan's hand held my elbow as we tried to see the speakers through the sunlight and the noise. Whispering in my ear, Jordan said he had never seen so many men with guns in his whole life, not even at Camp Pendleton. Hundreds of National Guardsmen had reinforced the highway patrol, and the air itself seemed gelatinous, unbreathable. Shiloh was speaking when we drew close enough to hear, but we were still 50 feet away from the speaker's platform. We heard Shiloh saying, "They brought the war home for us yesterday. Because we did not want our soldiers buried in an unjust war, they decided to bury some of us instead. Because we came in peace, they tried to show us what the price of peace was going to be. Because we hate war, they decided to declare war on all of us. Let us answer their gunfire by rededicating ourselves to the cause of bringing our soldiers home. Let us bury our dead, then go about our business of burying the Vietnam War forever." The applause that greeted her words was loud and insistent. Then Radical Bob moved toward the microphone. He had spoken but a few words when the head of the SLED, South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, agents, J.D. Strom, interrupted him and announced to the audience that no license to assemble had been granted by the city, and that this demonstration was canceled by order of the mayor. Shoving Strom aside, Radical Bob tried to commandeer the microphone, but his actions were broken off by a slim, swift-moving team that handcuffed him with great efficiency. The crowd roared malignantly as Radical Bob was dragged off and thrown into the back of a squad car. Students on the edge of the crowd tried to break through the cordon of officers to free Bob, but they were pushed back by a line of SLED agents. Capers negotiated nose to nose with Colonel Strom, then was allowed to use the microphone to make an announcement. "This meeting will reconvene in the theater of the Russell House. They may be able to stop us from talking to each other out here, but by God, we own the student union." So again, we moved, this time between the rifles, the pistols, and the batons of the forces of order. Yet we were orderly and wondered at the necessity of this dark show of paranoia and force. The eyes of the police officers were filled with loathing as they watched the disorderly but unthreatening passage of the students between their ranks. "They're worried about being killed," Jordan said. "The poor bastards are afraid of us." "Why do so many fat people go into law enforcement?" I asked. "Because they're wearing bulletproof vests. Stay in the middle," Jordan warned. "If they start shooting, they'll thin out the edges first." "They won't start shooting," I said. "These are just South Carolina country boys like us." "You think those National Guardsmen weren't just Ohio boys like those poor students?" Jordan said. "Don't make me more nervous than I already am," I said. "Let's go back to our rooms. I personally don't give a gerbil's fart for the whole Vietnam War." "Then that's a good reason to be here," Jordan said, but he did not explain what he meant. On the ramp leading into the Russell House, I saw two attack helicopters hovering in the distance. One girl carrying a radio said it was reported that another 1,000 National Guardsmen were mobilizing in Charleston. I watched highway patrolmen passing canisters of tear gas through their ranks and heard the barking of Dobermans and German Shepherds assembling behind the library. Already, the state had gathered enough firepower to eradicate a suburb of Hanoi, yet the enemy they faced were placing flowers and candy kisses into the holsters and cartridge belts of unsmiling patrolmen. When we reached the Student Union, Jordan and I stood in one of the overflowing aisles as Capers Middleton walked out to center stage and to the podium. Applause went up like a fire among drought-stricken pines, and grew in fury because our energy had been set off with no outlet. The cheering turned to screaming, and the screaming turned to a roar, tribal and irresistible. So many students had crowded into the theater and spilled out into the hallways and corridors that the police and the guard had mostly been left outside. We were alone with one another again. Capers, surprisingly, did not immediately start to speak. Instead, he enjoyed his first moment as a politician, as a man who had an instinctive appreciation for the ravenous needs of crowds. He watched the police and SLED agents force their way into the back of the auditorium and move through the students, whom they jostled and shoved out of their way, and he threw away the handwritten copy of the speech he had prepared. Once the phalanx of policemen had reached the front of the stage with their nightsticks at the ready, he began. "I'd like all of you to join me in singing a song most appropriate for this occasion. What we are truly doing is celebrating the greatness of this country. This is the country in which the British would not let us speak freely, assemble at will, or have a say in who would tax us. The British had thought of everything except one thing. We were no longer English. The country had changed us, and without knowing it, we had become Americans. As Americans, we taught the whole world about free speech. We invented it, and no one, I repeat, no one is going to take it away from us." Mike was up on stage, photographing the crowd's reaction, just as it erupted, electrified by the power of Capers's words. Jordan and I almost burst as we screamed until we were hoarse. "These poor cops are afraid of us. Let's show them there's no need to be afraid." Then Capers stood before the microphone and sang in his merely serviceable tenor voice, "O beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea." We all wept during the singing of America. Capers had managed to create a moment of great beauty. His instincts were accurate, his timing impeccable, and he seemed to exert leadership over the crowd by the authority of his presence alone. I had never seen a handsomer, more charismatic boy, and I felt myself falling in love with this best of friends all over again. Then law enforcement made their first strategic error. The city fire chief waddled out on stage, his saunter penguin-esque and uncertain, and one could sense his unease before our crowd of long-haired students. He wrestled the microphone away from Capers. During their brief struggle, Capers was smiling and playing to the crowd, but the fire chief did not come to this moment of time in a playful mood. He thought that Capers was mocking him. He motioned with his left hand, and the stage was suddenly filled with cops. One shot a small aerosol can of mace into Capers's eyes. Capers screamed, went down on his knees, when a baton struck the back of his legs, and he fell to the floor, face forward, as a cop hit his head with a blackjack. Capers was unconscious as they carried him off stage to an ambulance waiting outside. We were so astonished by the sudden turn of events that there was not a sound in the auditorium, and all I could actually hear was the shutter of Mike's camera opening and closing like the eyelids of some beast hidden from view. The fire chief spoke up at last.
"Mr. Middleton here didn't get a permit for this meeting. Y'all are busting every rule we got in the fire code. I'm authorized by the governor himself to issue a proclamation. Until further notice, no students will be allowed in the student union. Understood? No students allowed in the Russell House. You've got 5 minutes to disperse."
A murmur went through the leaderless crowd, and then I heard a voice beside me. It was Jordan speaking.
"Hey, Fatso, if the student union isn't for the students, then who in the hell is it for?"
"Arrest that boy,"
the fire chief said, turning away, but the PA system amplified his every word.
"I'm a student," Jordan yelled. "There's no law against a student being in his college's only student union. I want to know why all you damn cops and National Guardsmen are here. We built and paid for this house. We belong inside this house. You've come to our home and arrested and beaten our friends and interrupted our meeting and scared us in the place we feel safest. Then you've got the nerve to tell us we can't even be in the place that's got our name written on it."
"Do yourself a favor, son, and shut up," the fire chief said.
"Why should I shut up?" Jordan said. "I live here. My parents pay good money so I can attend classes here. I took tests so I could get into this college. All of us studied hard so we could get the chance to attend this university. You've no right to tell any of us to leave."
"You're creating a fire hazard," the chief said. "Only 2,000 people are allowed in this theater at one time."
"Then take the cops and soldiers and get your asses out of here. Then we'll have about the right number," Jordan said.
Policemen had already started moving toward Jordan, but the crowd made it very difficult for anyone to get near him. The colonel in charge of the National Guard and the head of SLED took the fire chief's place at the microphone.
"Listen, people," the colonel said.
His face had the soft, puffy texture of a woodland mushroom, but he clearly hated the students.
"I got me a little order here, an order granting me emergency powers issued by the governor's office. I just watched as you ignored an order to disperse by the fire marshal. I personally don't believe in the gentle, feel-good approach to mob rule. I want you to take your hippie asses and get the hell out of here."
Jordan spoke again, growing calm as the fury of the crowd spread around him, volatile as wildfire.
"Please apologize for calling us hippie asses, Colonel," Jordan asked. "I know my fellow students well, and we're very sensitive to name-calling. We've been burdened with tender sensibilities, and you just hurt our feelings."
"I gave an order to disperse, Betsy, or whatever your name is," the colonel said. "Sorry, I can't tell if you're a boy or a girl."
"Colonel," Jordan said, "why don't you and I have a fist fight on that stage, and you can find out if I'm a boy or not?"
The roar from the students drowned out the colonel's next words.
"And I'd like to remind this crowd of draft dodgers and peaceniks that there are fine young American men fighting and dying in Vietnam right now as we speak," the colonel said. "You know why these young men are dying?"
"Yeah, we sure do," Jordan screamed. "They weren't rich enough or lucky enough to be able to join the goddamn National Guard, like you and these pussies with rifles you've got us surrounded by."
Again, the rolling thunder of voices swept back and forth across that theater for several moments. The colonel tried several times to restore order, but his voice was puny, anemic. "Our boys are dying in Vietnam for a cause they believe in," Jordan continued finally, "and they've earned the love and respect of all of us. We now need to stop that war and bring them home. Our armed forces are out in the field killing the enemy, while you and your sorry National Guard, these chicken-shit, yellow-bellied bastards with their bayonets at ready, get to sit out the war, pretending you've done your duty to our country. You aren't out in the jungle hunting Viet Cong. Your guns are locked and loaded, and you've come on our campus to hunt your own American brothers and sisters. Yesterday, you killed 4 of us in Ohio. How many of us do you plan to kill today? Talk to me, National Guardsmen. I want one of you bastards to stand up and tell me that you aren't the biggest draft dodgers this country's ever seen. Tell me it wasn't the greatest day in your sorry lives when that piece of paper came in the mail saying you'd never catch malaria or clap in Vietnam.
You're inciting the riot, young man, the colonel said after the noise died down.
The students or the National Guard? Jordan asked. An exchange took place again at the podium, and a slick, well-dressed young man from the governor's office took the colonel's place and got right down to business. Any student found in the Russell House in 5 minutes will be suspended from the university for the rest of the semester. You will not be allowed to take exams or graduate with your class. Shouts and curses again filled the air, yet there was movement in the crowd toward the doors, and when all the shifting and maneuvering was over, 500 students still remained rooted in their spots. I looked around and was surprised to see that I did not recognize most of them, nor did I spot a single member of the SDS. The young man on stage presented a flawless style of no-nonsense leadership. His youth lent him an air of quiet, fascist authority. His angelic face, with his high coloring and good cheekbones, made him look like a candidate for water commissioner, or for leading a probe into ethical violations by union officials. More and more students began sneaking out, their heads down, running as soon as they reached the doors. When 5 minutes had passed, the young man, who identified himself as Christopher Fisher, announced that the 100 or so students still remaining, their eyes fierce in their loathing of him and the safety net he stood for in his button-down propriety, were expelled from the university. "Why am I here?" I said. "I should be back in the dorm studying for my Victorian novel exam." "Because you're a man of character," Jordan said, sitting easily beside me. "You've also never liked to cut and run just because an asshole told you to." "We are not graduating," I said, letting the full weight of my impulsive decision wash over me. "No diplomas, no walk across the stage, no handshakes and hugs from the parents. I'm not even sure I'm against the Vietnam War, and I'm not going to graduate because my friends are all fanatics, and my roommate just had a nervous breakdown right before my eyes." "They sent Capers to the hospital unconscious," Jordan said. "They arrested Shyla for giving a speech." "Oh, yeah," I said. "I knew there was a high moral principle involved that I don't even believe in. I knew I was ruining my whole life for a perfectly stupid reason." "Go on back to the room, then," Jordan suggested. "Then you'll think you're philosophically superior to me," I said. "I already think that," replied Jordan, smiling. "Charlotte never talked to me again," I mused aloud. Jordan nodded. "That's a given. Mike would take a photo of me sneaking out, cringing like a whipped dog." "It'd be in all the papers," Jordan agreed.
"But I could move to Alaska, where they've never heard of South Carolina," I said. "I could start a new life. Rumors of my cowardice would be dismissed. Or I could go to Vietnam, volunteer, become a Green Beret, cut the throats of village chieftains soft on the Viet Cong, win medals, get laid in Bangkok on R&R, parachute into the north and wreak havoc on supply lines, make a necklace out of human ears, step on a landmine, lose both legs and watch a small pig run away with my balls in its mouth, save up enough money to get an electric wheelchair, set off metal detectors because there's so much shrapnel in what's left of my dick. Nope, I'm staying." "Good decision," Jordan said. "But you were planning to join the Marines after graduation," I said. "It was going to be a gift to my father," Jordan said, smiling. "I wanted to give him a single chance in our life together to be proud of me." "I think you ought to see a career counselor to give you a few more options," I said, as the circle of policemen and guards tightened. Jordan said, "This'll hurt my chance for commandant." "Our parents are going to kill us," I said. "Oh, my God, my mother's going to hit the roof. She thinks she's earned my diploma. We can go to summer school." Then Christopher Fisher's voice echoed through the theater again. "All those students who do not leave the student union in the next 5 minutes will be arrested. A state of emergency has been called. You now have exactly 4 minutes and 40 seconds to return to your rooms."
Jordan stood up and said, "Yoo-hoo, fellas, you're not getting the big picture. Let's go over this one more time. This is our room. This is the student union. Student. You see a pattern here?" One of the students who had not said a word stood up at the far end of the dwindling circle. Though I did not recognize him, he looked far more warlike and menacing than the rest of us, with his shaggy, unkempt hair, greasy headband, and torn jeans. His camouflage jacket lent authority to his rage, and he began to scream orders to his fellow students. "If the pigs want this building, let's burn the fucker down and let them keep the ashes. This piece shit isn't working with these assholes. They want to kick some ass, let's kick back. They want to shoot a bunch of unarmed kids, let's go down while taking a few of them with us. I'm tired of talking, man. I want to kill me a pig." Jordan shouted for everyone to keep their seats, and he walked slowly over to the out-of-control student. He put his arm around the young man's shoulder, then grasped his neck with his hand. "Funny the way cops dress these days," Jordan said to the remaining demonstrators. "Anybody know this guy? I don't know a lot of you by name, but I've seen you around. I've been watching Mr. Radical here. He looks kind of overdressed, doesn't he? I mean, he'd look natural at Berkeley, but he's gone Hollywood on us down here in Dixie. Now he wants us to charge the guys with the guns. Makes a lot of sense, huh?" "Stool pigeon," some of the students started yelling. "Get lost, pal," Jordan suggested. "These are nice kids. Don't get them shot." "I hate this fucking war, man," the man shouted, appealing to the crowd. "Talk's bullshit. Action's what'll get their attention." I moved in behind him and pulled a wallet out of his back pocket. His police badge was standard issue. I lifted it up high so the other students could see that Jordan had guessed right. The students, chastened already by their expulsion, hissed until the lead character actor of the afternoon drama skulked away into the ranks of his brethren. "Everybody sure they want to be here?" Jordan said. "There's no shame in getting out of here now."
"They've got no right to do this,"
a graduate student named Elaine Scott said.
"How can they kick me out of my own school for sitting down in the student union?"
"I'm for the Vietnam War,"
a pretty girl named Laura Lee said, and I laughed when I recognized one of Ladare's tri-delts.
"But my mama and daddy taught me right from wrong, and this is all wrong."
Then the order was given, and the arrests were made. Chapter 37. When we left jail the next morning, we had become emblematic of our times, part of that troubling, despoiled era when Americans quit listening to one another. 200 students and 5 television cameras met us as we came out into the dazzling sunlight of a state where summer had come early. Shyla and Capers hugged us in triumph for the benefit of the cameras. Then they hustled us off to a quiet enclave on Blossom Street, where the SDS was planning its next move. The radicals who had only tolerated Jordan and me before now treated us as if we had proven ourselves in some fearful test of spite and venom. We were being cast as brothers in a circle we did not even like. But the night in jail had scared us, and being lionized and fussed over felt good, providing the balms that calmed our jangled spirits. The marijuana was free, and so was the Jack Daniels. I was high and happy when Shyla motioned to us to follow her. She led us to a backyard picnic table where Radical Bob had gathered a council of war for a meeting outside to ensure our conversations were not recorded. He was arguing that Jordan and I could not be trusted to attend this war council just because of a single arrest and a starring role in a demonstration that had spun out of everyone's control. He was afraid the movement had become the venue and training ground of amateurs, who were freelancing without a revolutionary philosophy to ground them. Already that day, 100 disheveled students had stormed the administration building in a spontaneous riot that had neither purpose nor leadership. "Action without philosophy is anarchy," Radical Bob said. "What?" I said. "Every time you open your mouth, Bob, it sounds like you learned your English at a Berlitz session." "Who asked you?" Radical Bob shot back. "Just because you and Jordan went out and played heroes yesterday, it certainly didn't help make this war one day shorter." "I noticed that none of you got arrested with us," Jordan said, looking around at the 22 veterans of SDS who sat in the yard around the picnic table. Many were passing joints back and forth, some so small it was as if they were trading pubic hairs pinched between thumbs and forefingers. On this day, except for Bob, the group was deferring to Jordan and me. By becoming front-page news, we had suddenly become valuable members of this very small South Carolina club.
"They risked everything, Bob," Shyla said, "and they lost everything. They got arrested along with all those other students. It's no surprise when people like you and me get arrested. It happens every day. But this was an uprising of anonymous students. No organization at all. Pure heroism. A battle cry of the common man. In one unplanned action, these students did more than the SDS has done in a year. Admittedly, they didn't know what they were doing, but it was brilliant."
"They shouldn't be a part of the action tonight," Bob said.
"I don't agree," Shyla said.
"You want to come with us?" Bob turned to me angrily.
"Then come on, motherfucker."
"Is it nonviolent?" Jordan asked.
"Of course. We're trying to end a war, not start one."
Jordan looked over at me and said, "I'm too drunk to say no. Besides, I don't have any exams tomorrow." "Or anywhere to go," I said. "They emptied our dorm room and chained it shut. We've got the rest of our lives to do what we want."
"Count us in," Jordan said.
At 2 the next morning, Capers Middleton, dressed in paramilitary regalia, broke a small window of a lavatory on the first floor of a Main Street building housing the Selective Service Office of South Carolina. He slipped through the darkness and came to the small door leading off an alleyway where a group of college students who would soon become known as the Columbia 12 had gathered. Forcing the door open, Capers put his fingers to his lips and led the rest of us into the interior of the building through the back staircase. The action had been planned for weeks, and everyone performed their duties perfectly in the first minutes of the break-in. Keys stolen from the busy janitors opened the right locks. The boys carried heavy buckets of cow's blood, and the girls brought all the incendiary material needed to burn the draft file of every boy in South Carolina. Shyla went to the first file cabinet, and with not a single wasted moment, pulled out the files and splayed them flat on the floor. Jordan and I followed her, covering each one with cow's blood. Capers led the group that was piling draft files into the center of a vast, colorless room. The pile grew higher and higher as Capers urged everyone to work faster. He checked his watch, nodded, and Radical Bob doused the files with gasoline. When Capers was exhorting everyone to superhuman effort, I noticed an edge to his voice and stopped what I was doing. My nostrils were overwhelmed by gasoline, and I was exhausted from a lack of sleep. I looked over and saw Shyla's face, which looked like a nun's in ecstasy. In fact, we all looked like a religious band about to ignite a heretic in some bizarre and surreally modern auto-da-fé. Alarms went off in me for no reason, and I studied the faces of these friends and complete strangers, trying to fight off a sense of panic. Backing away from the long rows of files, I grabbed Jordan by the shoulders as I saw Radical Bob light a match and the others flick cigarette lighters and move toward the mountain of draft files.
"Let's burn the whole goddamn building down," Radical Bob said.
"No," Shyla said, "just the files."
"Bob's right," Capers said. "If we're serious about the revolution, let's do the building. Let's do the whole town. Let's bring the war home. Show them what the Vietnamese people are going through."
"Shut up," Shyla said. "We are nonviolent. Nonviolent."
"Speak for yourself," Radical Bob said, and the room erupted in flame and light, and 100 sirens went off outside as cops and firemen burst into the room. An army of cops swarmed over us, knocking us to the floor with billy clubs and fists. 2 enormous men sat on me and handcuffed me, laughing when I howled in pain as they tightened the cuffs hard enough to cut the flow of blood into my wrists.
"Fucking pigs!" Capers was screaming. "Fucking pigs! Who ratted?"
"I told you to keep your goddamn friends out of it," Radical Bob said. "Everything about this was amateur hour."
"We did nothing wrong," Shyla said. "We tried to strike a blow for peace. We didn't totally succeed, but they know we've been here."
"Oh, shit," I heard Jordan moan.
"What's wrong?" I asked.
"We didn't think this one through," said Jordan. "This is a federal crime. We've stepped into some deep shit."
The day of our arraignment, we were taken in paddy wagons to the federal courthouse and had to run the gauntlet of news reporters and cameramen to enter the courthouse door. Mike was there, and he knew exactly what to look for. His Nikon was set correctly when General Elliot, resplendent in his creased, perfectly fitting Marine uniform, broke out of the crowd and walked swiftly down the stairs to meet his son. A detective was leading Jordan up the stairs, pulling the handcuffs that bound him. When the general backhanded Jordan to his knees, Mike got the photo. The general, in his iconic fury, looked every inch the figure of indignant, long-suffering authority, striking down the long-haired flouter of rules and law on the steps of a hall of justice. The photograph was a flawless cameo of almost biblical power, of a father re-establishing authority in his own home. Stricken and on his knees, Jordan's agonized expression reflected the shame and humiliation of a childhood that had gone on too long. In the nation's mind, General Elliot represented America to adults, but to us, he stood for everything that was tyrannical and immovable and dissembling in the American spirit, turned leprous by Vietnam. Jordan, on his knees, carried all the power of deep symbol. His face registered the traces of betrayal that his generation felt. Mike's photo was the last ticket on a point of no return. Like a beaten Christ figure, Jordan rose to face his father, walking up the step that separated them, staring into his father's eyes. Then General Elliot spit in his son's face, and the world they had in common went into sudden, irrevocable eclipse. The war and what it did to the soul of America played itself out in that brief encounter between father and son. It was the undoing of Jordan Elliot. He crossed over into a borderland of hurt where no one could follow. In jail, he forgot all about Vietnam and turned to what he could do that would most hurt his father. What could he do to break him? I had never before heard anyone pray with greater urgency, and Jordan was praying for the death of his father. When I was released into the custody of my parents, my father rose to the occasion of my defense. The legal peril I had brought down on myself inspired him to sobriety, and he handpicked the best criminal lawyers in the state to defend me. In private, he and my mother fought ferociously over our methods and tactics in protesting American involvement in Vietnam, but in public, they were just as vehement in supporting my actions against all comers. The more they studied the Vietnam War, the softer their defense of those policies became. By the time my trial began, both Lucy and the judge had turned indefatigable and fierce in protecting me. Shiloh's parents backed her with the same quiet zeal. Though Capus's parents disapproved of his every move, they too stood beside their radicalized, long-haired boy. Among the students arrested at the Russell House, almost every parent showed up to support their children when the gathering of lawyers, prosecutors, and judges took place in the high-windowed courthouses. Every single parent, except for General Elliot. To him, the matter was a simple one. We were all guilty of giving comfort and aid to the enemy. We were guilty of treason. When Jordan walked out of jail, the general was waiting for him, but this time he did not strike Jordan in front of the cameras. Instead of driving home to Pollock Island, General Elliot drove Jordan directly to the grounds of the South Carolina State Mental Hospital on Bull Street. A military doctor, an associate justice of the state Supreme Court, and the general himself all signed a document declaring that Jordan Elliot was mentally incompetent to stand trial and was to be hospitalized for mental observation starting on that day. South Carolina had the simplest rules in America for locking up its incompetents and lunatics. The trial took place in Columbia in early December. The passions loosed on America by the killings at Kent State had vanished and were replaced by an exhaustion that settled softly into the body politic. The whole country felt worn down and handicapped by years of force-fed tragedy. Outside on the courthouse steps, the last great anti-war rally in South Carolina was in session as I drove up with my parents and brothers to face the consequences of my actions the previous May. No matter how hard I tried to recreate those events in my mind, I could not figure out what drove me to such egregious defiance of authority. I had been called an all-American boy for so long that it was part of my own secret self-image. I had never received a speeding ticket in my life, never flunked a pop quiz, and never given my parents a moment's worry about my grades. After leading an exemplary student life, I now faced a 30-year prison sentence. I had thrown my diploma down the toilet because I had gotten angry at the deaths of four students I had never met, who went to a college I had never heard of, in a state I had never driven through in my life. The trial simply terrified me, and even Shiloh's bravado could not dim the sense of indistinctness and flatness I saw when I looked to the future. But under the harsh light of cameras again, outside the court with my father looking magisterial, my mother beautiful, and my brothers loyal, I whispered thanks to my family for sticking by me. When the bailiff cried out for the court to rise, Judge Stanley Carswell walked out of his chambers with long, deliberate strides. He looked severe until he sat down and smiled. He studied us for a brief moment, shook his head sadly, then got down to the business at hand. He entertained several motions, then said, "Will the prosecution call its first witness?" The prosecutor was a veteran of the pure Southern textbook variety. He was portly, loquacious, and had one of those Midland accents that conjured up salted hams hanging from dark rafters in a smokehouse. Sitting between Capers and me, Shiloh elbowed both of us when the prosecutor's sweet tang lifted through the crowd. He began, "Your Honor, I would like to call as the first witness for the state of South Carolina, Mr. Capers Middleton." In South Carolina, whatever infinitesimal, barely-breathing, white-knuckled spirit of the 60s still existed, died at that moment. Capers turned state's evidence against us. He named every name, told every secret, turned over every file, revealed every conversation, noted every date and expenditure and phone call in his diary, sent dozens of people up and down the East Coast to jail by the power of his testimony. The local chapter of the SDS folded during the first hour he spent in the witness chair. Carefully coached by the prosecutor, he described how J.D. Strom, the head agent of SLED, had recruited him to infiltrate the anti-war movement at the end of his junior year in college. Capers admitted that he had used his friendship with his childhood friend, Shiloh Fox, to gain access to the inner circles of radical activity on campus. If it had not been for Shiloh, Capers felt that he could never have won the trust of the true believers like Radical Bob Merrill. It was patriotism of the highest order and a fierce anti-communism that caused him to become an undercover agent for the state. His family had descended from one of the oldest and most distinguished in the South, and his love of country was second to none. He believed that the radicals he met, for the most part, constituted no danger to the state whatsoever. In fact, he still loved his friends, Shiloh, Jordan, and me, with all his heart, and thought that we were simply immature dupes who were highly suggestible to inflammatory rhetoric we could not understand. During the course of his five-day testimony, Capers used the word sheep-like enough times that Shiloh wrote a note to me saying Capers was making her feel like a rack of lamb. It was the one note of humor we managed during the course of the trial. And it was the same trial that changed everything about how we felt concerning friendship and politics and even love. The counsels for the defense tore into Capers Middleton with all the scorn and contempt that the judge would allow. They scoffed at his sincerity when he claimed he acted as he did only because he felt his country was in grave jeopardy. They taunted Capers by reading back the words of his own speeches and by playing videotapes of Capers denouncing the war in the most cutting, withering phrases of mockery. By trying to make a laughingstock out of his masquerade, they only succeeded in bringing out the bristling patriot in Capers. He matched the defense lawyers in their disdain during the taunting sessions of his cross-examination. He refused to acknowledge that he had betrayed us in any way, but sadly would admit that we may very well have broken faith with America. Then Capers spoke about Shiloh without being able to look her in the eye. Above everyone he met in the anti-war movement, Shiloh was the most passionate, articulate, and committed opponent of the war. Her idealism was unquestionable. She had served as his chief lieutenant, and he depended on her for an innate genius for strategy and for her fearlessness. He told the court again and again that Shiloh was the one person who acted from a deep sense of moral outrage against the Vietnam War. He attributed it to a longing for some earthly paradise that she had developed, growing up with a father who had survived Auschwitz and a mother who had watched her family murdered by the Nazis. Capers saved his most savage offensives for Radical Bob Merrill, the outsider from the great yawning beast of New York City. Employing the ancient southern fear of the carpetbagger and the scalawag, Capers wove a damning testimony about Merrill's subversiveness, his maladroit attempts to get them to move toward more and more radical acts. Bob's secret blueprint always called for violence. His voice was soft, but his ideas always ended with policemen dead and squad cars on fire. Radical Bob's most incantatory thought was thrilling and insurrect. His bottom line always was that the anti-war movement, if they were serious, should plan an incursion against the base at Fort Jackson itself. "These anti-war people are all phonies," Capers told the court. "Even though I personally thought Radical Bob was crazy and out of his gourd, he did make a valid point. If people really are opposed to a war, they should be willing to give up their lives for that belief. All these folks wanted to do was march with signs, smoke dope, and get laid. My ancestors fought against Cornwallis and Grant. They fought against the Kaiser and Hitler. They fought. They didn't talk. They took up arms. They didn't write speeches or compose slogans. Though Radical Bob's dangerous, he showed me what was wrong with this whole anti-war movement. They have no guts. They lack the courage of their convictions, and I'm happy to be one to expose them for the cowards they really are." The second witness for the prosecution did much to change the worldview of Capers Middleton. If a gasp of surprise went up among the shocked remnant of the Columbia 12 when Capers revealed that he had worked as an agent for the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, the earth itself seemed to open up when Radical Bob Merrill lifted out of his seat among the accused and took his place beside the judge as a witness for the government. The Federal Bureau of Investigation had recruited Bob as an informant during the troubles at Columbia University, and he had proven so valuable in his infiltration of that uprising that he was the natural choice when the local chapter of the FBI began to worry about subversive activities that arose when the UFO coffee house was founded to recruit young, disaffected soldiers into the movement. Neither the FBI nor the state of South Carolina had any notion that both had insiders passing out information from the same feebly populated SDS chapter. Though our defense proved that every illegal action we had participated in on the night of the break-in had been planned by either Capers or Radical Bob, we were found guilty of illegal trespass, breaking and entering, and malicious destruction of federal property. The judge sentenced us to a year in prison, but suspended that sentence due to our youth and obvious idealism. With quiet generosity, the judge gave us a real break. When Capers came to the witness chair in the Dock Street Theater, all of us were silent as he picked up the story of his involvement with the trial. Though he told his side of the story well, I could still feel his uneasiness over his part in bringing down his friends. One minute would find him defensive, but in the next, he would grow thoughtful as he tried to recall the passions and fears set loose during those harrowing days. With high-strung, nervous advocacy, Capers defended his actions as a form of patriotism and service to his country. When he signed up to work as a government agent, he had no way of knowing how Kent State would draw his closest friends into the trap he had set for the enemies of America. "Shyla loved you, Capers," I heard Ladere say. "Why did you pretend to love her back?" "I didn't pretend," Capers said, looking over at his ex-wife. "What I felt for Shyla was real. I never learned so much from anyone, never met anyone with such fine instincts for politics. She understood media, always made it work for us. I thought that later I would be able to explain to her what had happened, you know, on some occasion like this. My love for her was perfectly real. Hell, we all loved Shyla. We grew up with her. But I was looking at a bigger picture. I thought our country was in trouble. I knew that communists had infiltrated the anti-war movement. Unlike the rest of you, I had access to the agents." "Your friends weren't communists," Jordan Elliott said. "Jack and I weren't even political. Mike and Shyla were just against the war." The general answered his son sharply. "You did your duty to your country, Capers. You've nothing to answer for." "Capers has always been proud of what he did at Carolina," Ladere said. "We used to argue about it during our marriage."
"I wasn't proud," Capers corrected. "I was reconciled. There's a big difference."
If it wasn't for you and Shyla, Jordan and I wouldn't have even noticed Kent State, I said to Capers.
I take full responsibility for what I did, Capers said. I suggest you two do the same.
You kept me out of the demonstrations, Mike said to Capers. You made me the photographer, said I should record history. Was that because you were protecting me?
You were too impressionable, Capers said. I was protecting you from Shyla and your own worst instincts.
So you were setting Shyla up? Mike asked.
She had set herself up. Shyla helped shape the form my radicalism would take. My main focus was Radical Bob.
Ah, the irony, Bob said.
It's what always happens in bureaucracy, Capers said.
Were you paid a salary? Jordan asked.
Yes, of course, said Capers, as if surprised by the question. And I earned it, too.
As I listened to Capers and the others, it came back to me again how long it had taken me to recover the equilibrium I lost during that trial. I discovered that I did not have a revolutionary bone in my body, and if the judge had sentenced me to the front lines of an in-country unit in Vietnam, I would have accepted my duty with gratitude. The prosecution had accused me, day after day, of not loving my country, and that left deep marks on me. My country was what I woke up to every day, what I saw and breathed in around me. It was what I knew and loved without putting the tag on it, and what I would die for if it were ever in jeopardy and I heard it call my name. In the stronghold of my realist self, I was forced by the trial to confront the man I was and the one I was on the way to becoming. After the trial ended, Mike had met Capers Middleton outside the courtroom and taken three photographs of Capers with his arm around Radical Bob. Then he had set his Nikons down carefully and had punched Capers in the jaw. Onlookers had needed to pull Mike off his old friend. Throughout the long winter of 1971 that followed, I went through a period of self-inquiry and licking my wounds as I reviewed the damage I had done to my life. It was during this time that Shyla and I gravitated toward each other. As I look back on it, I suppose our dance together was inevitable. We were like moons that gave off no light, attracted to the same illusory orbit. Shyla could barely recover her self-respect after having slept with Capers and having shared every secret with him for more than a year. It was not that he had lied about the war that most troubled her. It was that he had told her every night about his love for her, his undying admiration for all she stood for, his adoration of her body, and his ardent desire that they spend their entire lives together. That she could not sense such treachery and dissimulation in her own lover disturbed her far more than that he'd been secretly working for the state. It was not any residue of Capers and his bad faith she feared, but she did not know how to ever regain trust in herself and her own judgments again. Shyla had always considered herself reliable and incorruptible, but never had she thought of herself as an easy mark or gullible to the point of dishonor. She could easily accept the legal consequences of her own actions, but she could not bear being made a laughingstock or a fool for love. So she turned to me and I turned to her, neither of us knowing that we were both keeping a ruthless appointment with a bridge in Charleston.
Chapter 38.
When Jordan took the seat on the Dock Street stage next to my father, I realized that now all the pieces and small fragments of what happened to him would become a whole. I had always been hesitant to ask too many questions about a period of time both of us had found contaminated, and he had not volunteered any information. As Jordan spoke, I felt him relax under the steely gaze of his father for the first time. He spoke in a voice that was matter-of-fact, businesslike. His recreation of events came easily to him, and I suddenly remembered why my church taught that confession was good for the soul. As he talked, all of us leaned forward to hear each word articulated by this remote, soft-spoken man. Even the general leaned forward in his chair.
It was almost immediately after I arrived at Bull Street that I was thrown into solitary confinement in a room without furniture. The doctors had given me drugs to calm my fury over being committed, but I had continued to scream at the nurses, night attendants, and other patients, so they isolated me as much as possible. They also increased the dosage of my drugs until I was barely coherent. When I was returned to the ward, no visitors were allowed, and I could receive letters from no one except my parents. I'm not sure when it was, but soon after, I received the first of four shock treatments, which calmed me almost to the point of insentience. I shuffled among the main populace of the most serious psychotics for months, wandering through a thick haze of cigarette smoke, past men poleaxed by Thorazine. But what had looked like madness to the doctors and nurses was my inability to come to terms with my father's betrayal. The shock treatments made me forget, but eventually memory returned slowly, and when it did, it hurt. When I remembered my father's slap and his saliva running down my face, I tried to kill myself by hanging from a belt I had stolen from a sleeping guard. Later, I tried to hang myself with bedsheets and was treated to another round of shock treatments. My mother came to visit me twice a week. I stayed at Bull Street until the following May. I had been there almost a year when they let me go. My release caught everyone by surprise.